White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to another episode of one of the greatest exposés of the danger posed by the Jew in non-Jewish societies ever written. Notice I said one of them, because I don't know how many other great ones there might be, but I think this one is pretty good, and we're now on chapter 37 tonight, and I think we've gotten a whole lot out of it already. So let me say that it's April 4th, 2013, and I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And as I said, Hadding, we're on to chapter 37 tonight. Disraeli, British Premier, portrays the Jews. And I thought, well, I know all about Disraeli and Coningsby. And all of that, so, you know, this is not going to be much new, but I found it very interesting, and I did learn quite a bit, probably things I had forgotten about, you know. And so I thought it was very, very revealing. In fact, it got me going again. It got me all, you know, angry and, you know, cursing people and so on. So it's got to be a good chapter. What do you think about it?
Well, it's kind of valuable because it shows that Disraeli confirms a lot of things, you know. Even though he presented the information in the form of a novel, it's obviously supposed to have verisimilitude, and you know, he's confirming that Jews control a lot of things.
Yes, he is, and you know, I think it's a matter that. These Jews are proud of it. They're proud of who they are. And Disraeli, despite the fact that he was a Christian or was baptized at the young age of something, I've forgotten now, and, you know, and pretended like he was always real. But he still was very proud of his Jewish heritage and the role of the Jews. And I don't know if he really saw the Jews as such a powerful people or if they like to portray themselves as such powerful people, because by doing so, they convince other people that they're so powerful, and it helps keep the fear of the Jews going. I had some thoughts like that as I was reading it. So we'll see, you know, we'll pick that up as we go along. So anytime you want to start.
Okay, chapter 37, Disraeli, British Premier, portrays the Jews. The Jews have complained that they are being misrepresented. It is their usual complaint. They are always being misrepresented and persecuted, except when they are being praised for what they are not. If the Jews were fully understood by the Gentiles, if the Christian churches, for example, were freed from their delusion that the Jews are Old Testament people, and if the churches really knew what Talmudic religion is, it is likely that the misrepresentation would be still stronger.
No, there's that thing, you know, that I was talking about last week, And I think maybe I had read ahead a little bit and I saw it here, but you know, here they're making it very clear, as they have before, these writers mostly, but Ford obviously went along with it, that they don't think the Jews are the Old Testament people, and they don't say who they think they are exactly, but they make that real clear, and that could be, like you said, but it's most likely to be from a British Israel influence, I think.
I don't think British Israelism denies that the Jews are the Hebrews. They just say that British people are also. I think that's British Israelism.
Well, maybe there's different branches. I can't see that they would say that, but I know that British Israel is supposed to be more friendly, more Jew-friendly than what identity Christianity or Christian identity is. So,
Herbert Armstrong, Worldwide Church of God, right?
Well, I think that then that this Cameron, he may have started as British Israel, and then, I could have this all mixed up, but, and then he did become Christian identity. Somebody there did switch to that, and I think it was him. And they say that, you know, that they're not, absolutely, and they're not Jew friendly either. He's talking right here in this first paragraph, very tough against the Jews. You can tell they don't like Jews, the people who they are anti-Semites, even though they want to deny it. But they don't like Jews. You can tell by the way they write. Well, they wouldn't write the book if they did, but, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get really, really pretty sharp sometimes, which I like.
Well, it's a dislike that's based on things that Jews are doing, though. It's not that they dislike, it's not a religious bias.
Well, here's the thing. I guess I just I don't define anti-Semitism the way maybe they want it to be defined, that I just somehow hate Jews because they're Jews or something. I don't think there's no such thing as that. You know,
well, there probably is. It probably has been. You know, there are people that to this day probably still call the Jews Christ killers.
Well, why not? That doesn't mean you hate Jews because they're Jews. You hate them for something they've done. So
they
everything about
you're
it.
Christ killer, okay.
Well, everything is about something they've done, and people would see that differently, I guess. But yeah, it's the way they behave. You know.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Ford, I don't think he has any truck with that Christ killer stuff.
Well, you don't know, and let's not get onto that, all right? Because we don't know what Ford really thought. But there is some interesting stuff in here about Freemasonry. So I guess we should move on so we have time to talk about that.
All right.
Okay.
The downfall of Russia was prepared by a long and deliberate program of misrepresentation of the Russian people through the Jewish world press and Jewish diplomatic service. Boy, they do that every time. They did that to Hitler and they did that to Saddam Hussein. It took 15 years to get public opinion in line for eliminating Saddam Hussein. Took about the same time to get the world in a war with Germany. About the same time.
Well, there you go. See, so they're planning ahead. That's conspiracy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The name of Poland has been drawn in filth through the press of the United States under Jewish instigation. Most of the signers of the latest Jewish protest against the Dearborn Independence Articles being leaders in the vilification of Poland, whose sole crime is that she wishes to save herself from the Jews. All this real misrepresentation is regarded as the Jews' privilege.
Hmm.
But wherever a hand has been raised to prevent the Jews overrunning the people and secretly securing control of the major instruments of life, the Jews have raised the cry of misrepresentation. They never meet the question outright. They are not meeting it now. They cannot meet it without confession, false denials, pleas for sympathy, and an unworthy attempt to link others with them in their fall constitute their whole method of defense. Freemasons may wonder how they come into this affair, as they see the name of their ancient order coupled with that of the Jews in the latest Jewish defense. It is all very easily understood by those who are acquainted with the Jewish strategy during the two centuries which comprise modern Masonic history. Twice in the history of the United States, the people have been aroused by a sense of strange influences operating in their affairs, and each time the real power behind the influences was able to divert suspicion to the Freemasons. And I just want to say that this is a staple of kosher patriot media. People like Milton William Cooper, who looks for all the world like a Jew. And then all of his imitators, down to Alex Jones. All of these people want to talk about Freemasons
mm-hmm.
instead of Jews.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. We know that. We know that. But there are a lot of people who also, well, Deanna Spingola is one, who before she ever talked about Jews, she was already talking about Freemasons, I think. And who see the Freemasons as an evil influence and really the Jews behind it all. Now, they're saying here that it's just a couple of instances where the Jews are trying to connect them what they've done with Freemasonry, but the book here is defending Freemasonry as being basically okay, except when the Jews get control of it. Well, it seems like the Jews are in control about most of it. But, well, we'll go on because this is very controversial. But I have to say that when I was saying last week, I think it was, that that I didn't think that Ford was a serious Freemason, that I may be wrong. I may have been wrong about that.
Yeah, well.
They are here really defending Freemasonry as they don't really say what they think it is. But obviously they think that everything that's wrong is the Jews and not the Freemasons. So this is they obviously think that the Freemasonry program is fine and innocent. And obviously then too, probably Ford did believe in a kind of an elite understanding of raising your consciousness and so on, as the Freemasons say that they do. And maybe he thought that the Christianity was more for the masses and that they needed a regular religion, but other people could go into Freemasonry and learn the higher spiritual truths and so on. And he was one of those because he did seem to defend Christianity quite a bit. But he may have thought, like so many people do, that this was what the people needed. He was good about caring about the people and, you know, making their life better, you know, with the way he ran his car company and gave good salaries to the people and, you know, did good things for them. Kind of a paternalism type of thing, you know. And he liked National Socialism, so that was, in a sense, a kind of a paternalism toward your own people, looking after your own people and letting them have what they need in the way of religion, even if you don't share it. Exactly. Things like that. Well, I should be quiet now.
All right. So, about Jews diverting attention to the Freemasons. Mm-hmm. Once in George Washington's time, once in President Adams' time, this occurred. Books were written, sermons preached, newspapers took up the search, but none of the observers saw the Jewish influence there. George Washington knew that the disloyal influence was not Masonic, but he saw signs of the concealed power trying to operate under the guise of Masonry. President Adams had not so clear a view of the matter. Masonry emerged unstained because it was guiltless of subversive purposes. A pseudo-Masonry of French origin, given to atheistic and revolutionary purposes, strongly patronized by Jews, was the disturbing element. But all that the public was able to see was the Masonic similitude and not the Jewish hand.
Now, I think what he's referring to there is that Crémieux and his beginning, you know, with those Jews in France of their Freemasonic lodges. And then they did that alliance, Israelite Universel, and that was all Jewish. I really think that's what they're referring to. And that's tied in with, in my mind, with the protocols, too. So in some way.
Grand Orient Freemasonry is the Freemasonry that's particularly associated with the subversion on the European continent. Mm-hmm. That's probably mm-hmm. what he means. This is distinguished from Anglo-American.
Yeah, but that was French, and Cremieux was the head of the became the head of the Grand Mason Lodge, Grand Orient Lodge, and he also was in this other smaller one that was more secret. But that was the one that they kind of took over. So that fits.
Well, Nesta Webster says that all the degrees of Masonry above the third are based on the Jewish Kabbalah.
Yeah, but she might, I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know that she knew everything. But then I've never studied her really, so I don't want to say anything that I don't know.
A recrudescence of this misrepresentation of the Masons occurred also in 1826, and from then until the other day, when the leaders of American Jewry linked the name of Freemasonry with their own. The name of the order has been unscathed.
So Freemasonry has not been touched with any scandal, huh? That's what they're trying to say.
Well, perhaps the real Freemasonry as Ford conceives it.
Yeah.
This is to serve notice on the leaders of American Jewry that this time they will not be permitted to hide behind the name of Masonry, nor will they be permitted to hold up the name of Masonry as a shield to blunt the darts or as an ally to share the shafts aimed at their subversive purposes.
This is the last thing I'm going to say. Once again, though, they have to make these claims of what they're going to stop. This is not going to happen anymore. And they fail. You know, it failed. Because you can't say that did take place, that's the truth. They haven't. They're still hiding behind Masonry. I mean, they're still using Masonry. Wouldn't you say they're... I don't really know what Masonry is doing these days.
I think that, I tell you what, I've seen a Masonic Bible in a secondhand bookstore, and there were several Jewish names in it. And basically, whenever you have a certain number of Jews involved in any organization, that organization is going to be kosher just by the influence of those Jews there, the fact that they push, the fact that they're unified and organized. That's the way it works, I think. I'm not sure that Masonry in general is controlled by Jews at the top. I don't see any indication, for example, that Albert Pike was a Jew or was subordinate to Jews.
Well, but they're saying here that this is, you know, they're serving notice on the leaders of American Jewry. Well, I don't think that they ever went out with that.
Freemasonry today really doesn't amount to much.
That's what it feels like. I never hear anything about it.
Yeah. It used to be that everybody who was anybody, in the South at least, was a Freemason. So it didn't really mean that somebody was a member of a conspiracy mm-hmm. or a subversive. It was normal, basically.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying last week for Ford. I thought, well, it was just something everybody was doing at that time,
yeah.
And it's kind of fallen in disfavor, but I have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, probably nothing has stimulated growth of Freemasonry in the past couple of decades as much as all the conspiracy theorizing in Patriot media.
Okay.
I would wager. That game has succeeded twice in the United States. It will never succeed again. Freemasonry is not and never was implicated in what the Jewish cabal has had in mind. And Freemasons everywhere are aware of the facts.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. It is a curious fact that just as the Jews have sought to operate through the Masons, and then leave that order to take the brunt of the ensuing assault, so also have they at times sought to operate through the Jesuits, playing the same trick with that name and order. If the Jesuits and the Masons would compare notes, they could both report the same thing. Jews have sought to use both, and have been frustrated, although in consequence the names of both orders have suffered for a time. This is one of the coincidences between the protocols and the facts. The protocols express themselves as against both the Masons and the Jesuits, but willing to use both to attain Jewish purposes. Both these orders are well able to take care of themselves once they know the key to the Jewish plan. But there is much information on these matters of which the public is not aware, and at a future date a study may be made of the historical efforts of the Jews to use and destroy Freemasonry. Such a study will be useful in showing how Jewish influence operated in a day when the people had no means of identifying it as Jewish. The people attacked the thing they saw, but what they saw was not the source of the element they opposed. Progress has been made at least to this extent, that nowadays, more than at any previous time, the world plan of the Jews is known and recognizable. The main purpose of the present article, however, is to show the reader that the Jews have not been misrepresented, the means of showing this being a presentation of the Jews by a notable Jew, whom the Jews are delighted to honor. Benjamin Disraeli, who was Earl of Beaconsfield and Prime Minister of Great Britain, was a Jew and gloried in it. He wrote many books, in a number of which he discussed his people in an effort to set them in a proper light. The British government was not then so Jewish as it has since become, and Disraeli was easily one of the greatest figures in it. In his book Coningsby, there appears a Jewish character named Sidonia, in whose personality and through whose utterances Disraeli sought to present the Jew as he would like the world to see him. Sidonia first announces his race to young Coningsby by saying, "I am of that faith that the apostles professed before they followed their master." The only place in the whole book where the faith is mentioned. Four times, however, in the brief preface to the fifth edition, written in 1849, the term race is used in reference to the Jews. In the first conversation between these two, Sidonia reveals himself as a great lover of power, and discourses charmingly of the powerful men of history, ending in this way. "Acquaviva was general of the Jesuits, ruled every cabinet in Europe, and colonized America before he was 37. What a career!" exclaimed the stranger, Sidonia, rising from his chair and walking up and down the room. "The secret sway of Europe." Page 120. The references are to Longman's edition, published in 1919. Taking up a study of the character of Sidonia the Jew, Disraeli the Jew begins to refer to the Jews as Mosaic Arabs. If a modern writer were to describe the Jews thus, virtually as Arabs of the Mosaic persuasion, it would be denounced as another attempt at persecution. But Disraeli did this a number of times, his purpose evidently being to give the Jew his proper setting as to his original position among the nations. Again, he refers to them as Jewish Arabs. Both of these terms may be found on page 209. Disraeli also gives voice to the feeling which every Jew has, that whoever opposes the Jew is doomed. This is a feeling which is strongly entrenched in Christians also, that somehow the Jews are the chosen people, and that it is dangerous to oppose them in anything. The fear of the Jews is a very real element in life. It is just as real among the Jews as among non-Jews. The Jew himself is bound in fear to his people, and he exercises the fear of the curse throughout the sphere of religion. I will curse them that curse thee. It remains to be proved, however, that opposition to the destructive tendencies of Jewish influences along all the principal avenues of life is a cursing of the Jews. If the Jews were really Old Testament people, if they were really conscious of a mission for the blessing of all the nations, the very things in which they offend would automatically disappear. If the Jew is being attacked, it is not because he is a Jew, but because he is the source and life of certain tendencies and influences, which, if they are not checked, mean the destruction of a moral society.
Now that's what I'd call anti-Semitism, right? And that's why I spell it as, after reading Wilhelm Marr, who some people say he invented the word anti-Semitism, but he was not the first one, I guess, to use it. Some Jew was, but he made a big point of saying that you don't, it's all one word with a small s. It's not two words with a hyphen. And it makes a difference, and he explains what that difference is. But it is sort of like that you are against this whole Jewish activity in your society. It's not against individual people or something. It's not because you hate the persons, but you know it's what they do. And if you're against that totally across the board, pretty much, well, then that's anti-Semitism, and that's why I defend it. Okay.
The persecution of the Jew to which Disraeli refers is that of the Spanish Inquisition, which rested on religious grounds. I suspect there was more to it than just religion. Tracing the Sidonia family through a troubled period of European history, our Jewish author notes, during the disorders of the Peninsular War, a cadet of the younger branch of this family made a large fortune by military contracts and supplying the commissariat of the different armies. Page 212. Certainly, it is a truth unassailable, applicable to any period of the Christian era, that persecuted or not, wars have been the Jews' harvests. They were the first military commissaries. If this young Sidonia, in supplying the different armies, went so far as to supply the opposing armies, he would be following quite perfectly the Jewish method as history records it. And at the peace, prescient of the great financial future of Europe, confident in the fertility of his own genius, in his original views of fiscal subjects, and his knowledge of natural resources, this Sidonia resolved to emigrate to England, with which he had, in the course of years, formed considerable commercial connections. He arrived here after the Peace of Paris with his large capital. He stakes all that he was worth on the Waterloo loan, and the event made him one of the greatest capitalists in Europe. Of course, that's pretty close resemblance to the Rothschild story.
Yes, it is. I thought the same thing. Is that made up or something, or what?
No sooner was Sidonia established in England than he professed Judaism. Sidonia had foreseen in Spain that after the exhaustion of a war of 25 years, Europe must require capital to carry on peace. He reaped the due reward of his sagacity. Europe did require money, and Sidonia was ready to lend it to Europe. France wanted some, Austria more, Prussia a little, Russia a few millions. Sidonia could furnish them all. The only country which he avoided was Spain. Page 213. Here the Prime Minister of Great Britain, from the wealth of his traditions as a Jew, and the height of his observation as Prime Minister, describes the method of the Jew in peace and war, exactly as others have tried to describe it. He puts forward the same set of facts as others put forth, but he does it apparently for the Jews' glorification, while others do it to enable the people to see what goes on behind the scenes in war and peace. Sidonia was ready to lend money to the nations. But where did he get it in order to lend it? He got it from the nations when they were at war. It was the same money. The financiers of war and the financiers of peace are the same, and they are the international Jews, as Benjamin Disraeli's book for the glorification of Jewry amply testifies. Indeed, he testifies on the same page just quoted. It is not difficult to conceive that after having pursued the career we have intimated for about 10 years, Sidonia had become one of the most considerable personages in Europe. He had established a brother or a near relative in whom he could confide in most of the principal capitals. He was lord and master of the money market of the world, and of course, virtually lord and master of everything else. Again, that's like the Rothschilds, except it was the father that established the brothers in different places.
Would you think he was using the Rothschilds as a model?
With a few things changed.
Okay.
This comes as near being the international Jew as anything can be. But the Jews glory in the picture. It is only when a non-Jewish writer suggests that perhaps it is not good for society that a Jewish coterie should be lord and master of the money market of the world, and as a consequence, lord and master of everything else, that the cry of persecution arises. Strangely enough, it is in this book of the British Premier that we come upon his recognition of the fact that Jews had infiltrated into the Jesuits' order. Young Sidonia was fortunate in the tutor to whom his father had procured for him, and who devoted to his charge all the resources of his trained intellect and vast and various erudition. A Jesuit before the revolution, since then an exiled liberal leader, now a member of the Spanish Cortes, Rebelo was always a Jew. He found in his pupil that precocity of intellectual development which is characteristic of the Arabian organization. Page 214.
What does that mean? And before they talked about the Arabian, what was that? The Arabian Jews. Arabian means, is that a reference to the Sephardic Jews?
I'm not sure. I think my best guess is that organization here means constitution. In other words, saying that Arabs in general are precocious.
Something like that.
That's my guess. Because he wouldn't want to say that Sephardic Jews or North African Jews, which would be, what, Mizrahi Jews, I guess, Maghrebi Jews, maybe. You wouldn't want to say that they're sharper than the other Jews. Probably they aren't.
Right. Well.
Then followed in young Sidonia's career an intellectual mastery of the world. He traveled everywhere, sounded the secrets of everything, and returned with the world in his vest pocket, so to speak. A man without illusions of any sort.
Well, see, I suspect that this is a this typical overestimation of Jewish potential and Jewish greatness and so on that they like to indulge in, even this Disraeli, who people seem to put so much faith into, because they do it, they just do it, and I think it makes a lot of people believe it who, you know, more than they would otherwise. I think it works in their favor to do that. I'm very skeptical about their claims.
Depends. It works in their favor to say that people will suffer for opposing the Jews. That definitely helps them.
Well, they make him seem so you know, glorified. They're not that brilliant, but anyway, I just wanted to get that in there.
There was not an adventurer in Europe with whom he was not familiar. No minister of state had such communication with secret agents and political spies as Sidonia. He held relations with all the clever outcasts of the world. The catalogue of his acquaintances, in the shape of Greeks, Armenians, Moors, secret Jews, Tartars, Gypsies, and wandering Poles and Carbonari, would throw a curious light on those subterranean agencies of which the world in general knows so little, but which exercise so great an influence on public events. The secret history of the world was his pastime. His great pleasure was to contrast the hidden motive with the public pretext of transactions. Pages 218 to 219. Here is the international Jew, full dress. He is the protocolist also, wrapped in mystery, a man whose fingers sweep all the strings of human motive and who controls the chief of the brutal forces, money. If a non-Jew had limbed a Sidonia, so truthfully showing the racial history and characteristics of the Jews, he would have been subjected to that pressure which the Jews applied to every truth-teller about themselves. But Disraeli could do it, and one sometimes wonders if Disraeli was not, after all, writing more than a romance, writing, indeed, a warning for all who can read. The quotation just given is not the description of Sidonia only. It is also a description, save for the high culture of it, of certain American Jews who, while they walk in the upper circles, have commerce with the adventurers and with the secret agents and political spies and with the secret Jews and with those subterranean agencies of which the world in general knows so little. This is the strength of Jewry, this commerce between the high and the low. For the Jew knows nothing disreputable within the circles of Jewishness. No Jew becomes an outcast, whatever he may do. A place and a work await him, whatever his character. There are highly placed persons in New York who would rather not have it known what they contributed to the adventurer who left New York to overturn Russia. There are other Jews who would rather not have it printed how much they know of secret agents and political spies. Disraeli did more than draw Sidonia. He portrayed the international Jew as he is found also in America. Thus far, Sidonia is described from the outside, but now he begins to speak for himself, and it is in behalf and praise of the Jews. He is discussing the discrimination practiced against his people in England. It is the old story. Everywhere, even in the United States, the same story. Crying for pity while usurping power. We are poor Jews, wails a New York multimillionaire at whose fingers legislatures quail and even presidents of the United States grow respectful. The following quotation was written in 1844. Britons must be impressed with its uncanny parallel to their affairs today. It is Sidonia speaking. Yet since your society has become agitated in England, and powerful combinations menace your institutions, you find the once loyal Hebrew invariably arrayed in the same ranks as the leveler and latitudinarian, and prepared to support the policy which may even endanger his life and property, rather than tamely continue under a system which seeks to degrade him.
Sure.
Consider that latitudinarianism is the doctrine of the protocols in a word. It is a breakup by means of a welter of so-called liberal ideas, which construct nothing themselves, but have power to destroy the established order.
I think that's a great word. I'd never seen it used. It's giving too much latitude. And it's better put than a lot of other words that we use. You know, because it's so easy to give too much latitude, give more latitude. And that is the road as you go down. And this is, you know, when you get real, you have to be real hardcore about this stuff. Or the next thing you know, you've lost so much ground from latitudinarianism.
Well, apparently latitudinarianism started out as a religious movement in the 1600s in England.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what was that? What was the religion about?
Well, it was a movement within the Church of England for, you know, latitude.
Yeah, they wanted more. They didn't want to be so strict.
Yeah. I think they wanted to have more leeway for individual interpretation or something like that. Mm-hmm. Note also Disraeli's answer to the question sometimes asked, if the Jews suffer under Bolshevism, Note also Disraeli's answer to the question sometimes asked, if the Jews suffer under Bolshevism, why do they support it? Or the Jewish spokesman's form of it. If we are so powerful, why do we suffer in the disorder of the world? The disorder is always a step to a new degree of Jewish power. Jews suffer willingly for that. But even so, they do not suffer as the non-Jews do. The Soviets permit relief to enter Russia for the Jews. In Poland, the starving war sufferers are able to glut all available ships in taking high-priced passage to America. They are not suffering as other people are, but as Disraeli sees, they are willing to suffer because they see in every breakdown of Gentile society a new opportunity for the Jewish power to dig nearer the central seat of power.
Well, the Holocaust is a perfect example of that, some Jews had to suffer a bit, but look how far they got by it. And I've heard Jews say that, my God, you know, they have so much that today that they never dreamed of having before that Holocaust happened, before World War II and so on. So they gained tremendously from it.
And Chaim Weizmann, the head of the World Zionist Organization, said in the 1930s that he would rather see every Jew in Germany die of disease than have Palestine lost as a Jewish homeland.
Yeah, right. And they also said that, well, I don't know, I won't quote it right, but yeah, they said things like that. Exactly right.
Just how the Jew works to break down the established order of things by means of ideas, or as the protocols claim, is shown in the same conversation of Cydonia. The Tories lose an important election at a critical moment. 'Tis the Jews come forward to vote against them. The Church is alarmed at the scheme of a latitudinarian university and learns with relief that funds are not forthcoming for its establishment. A Jew immediately advances and endows it. If these words had been written by a non-Jew, the cry of anti-Semitism would ring through the land. They are true, neither more nor less true, because written by a Jew. And Cydonia adds, and every generation they must become more powerful and more dangerous to the society that is hostile to them. These quotations from page 249. Well, several generations have passed since these words were written. The Jew still regards every form of non-Jewish society as hostile to him. He organizes strongly against society. And if Disraeli is to be taken as a prophet, his words remain. They must become more powerful and more dangerous. They have become more powerful. Whoso would measure the danger, look around. Let the charming Cydonia proceed with his revelations. I told you just now that I was going up to town tomorrow, because I always made it a rule to interpose when affairs of state were on the carpet. Otherwise, I never interfere. I hear of peace and war in newspapers, but I am never alarmed, except when I am informed that the sovereigns want treasure. Then I know that monarchs are serious. It will be remembered that Cydonia held no governmental position. The time had not come for that. Power was exercised behind the scenes, long before the craving for the spotlight was gratified. But whether there be Jews in office or not, the power they exercise behind the scenes is always greater than the power they show in the open. It can be seen, therefore, that the more numerous they are in office, the greater their secret power. Cydonia continues, A few years back we were applied to by Russia. Now there has been no friendship between the court of St. Petersburg and my family. It has Dutch connections which have generally supplied it, and our representations in favor of the Polish Hebrew, a numerous race, but the most suffering and degraded of all the tribes, have not been very agreeable to the Tsar. However, circumstances drew to an approximation between the Romanovs and the Cydonias. I resolved to go myself to St. Petersburg. I had on my arrival an interview with the Russian Minister of Finance, Count Kankrin. I beheld the son of a Lithuanian Jew. The loan was connected with the affairs of Spain. I resolved on repairing to Spain from Russia. I traveled without intermission. I had an audience immediately on my arrival with the Spanish minister, Señor Mendizabel. I beheld one like myself, the son of a Nuevo Cristiano, a Jew of Aragon. In consequence of what transpired at Madrid, I went straight to Paris to consult the president of the French Council. I beheld the son of a French Jew, a hero, an imperial marshal. If Cydonia were traveling today, he would find whole groups of Jews, where in his day he found one, and he would find them in exalted places. Suppose Disraeli were alive today and should revise Coningsby, including the United States in the tour of this money master of the world. What a host of Jewish names he could gather from official circles in Washington and New York. Such a host, indeed, as makes the occasional Gentile look like a foreigner who had been graciously permitted to come in by the Jews. The consequence of our consultations was that some northern power should be applied to in a friendly and mediative capacity. We fixed on Prussia, and the president of the council made an application to the Prussian minister, who attended a few days after our conference. Count Arnim entered the cabinet, and I beheld a Prussian Jew. Cydonia's comment upon all this is offered as an address to every reader of this article. So you see, my dear Coningsby, that the world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes. Pages 251-252. It is indeed. Why not let the world see behind the scenes for a little? And now for the most illuminating lines Disraeli ever wrote, lines which half compel the thought that maybe, after all, he was writing to warn the world of Jewish ambition for power. You never observe a great intellectual movement in Europe in which the Jews do not greatly participate. The first Jesuits were Jews. That mysterious Russian diplomacy which so alarms Western Europe is organized and principally carried on by Jews. That mighty revolution which is at this moment preparing in Germany, and which will be, in fact, a second and greater reformation, and of which so little is yet known in England, is entirely developing under the auspices of the Jews. Page 250. And interesting that he implies there that the Reformation may have been a Jewish operation.
Yeah, that's going a little far. He doesn't say the Jews. Several times you've said you've read it as the Jews. He always just says Jews. Just thought I'd point that out. Developing under the auspices of Jews.
Okay, you're correct.
Yeah.
American Jews say that the protocols are inventions. Is Benjamin Disraeli an invention? Was this Jewish Prime Minister of Great Britain misrepresenting his people? Are not his portrayals taken as true history? And what does he say? He shows that in Russia, the very country where the Jews complained they were least free, the Jews were in control. He shows that the Jews know the technique of revolution, foretelling in his book the revolution that later broke out in Germany. How did he foreknow it? Because that revolution was developing under the auspices of Jews. And though it was then true that so little is yet known in England, Disraeli the Jew knew it, and knew it to be Jewish in origin and development and purpose. One point is sure. Disraeli told the truth. He presented his people before the world with correctness. He limns Jewish power, Jewish purpose, and Jewish method with a certainty of touch that betokens more than knowledge. He shows racial sympathy and understanding. He sets forth the facts which this series is setting forth. Why did he do it? Was it boastfulness, that dangerous spirit in which the Jew gives up most of his secrets? Or was it conscience, impelling him to tell the world of Judah's designs? No matter, he told the truth. He is one man who told the truth without being accused of misrepresenting the Jews.
All right, very good. That was December 18th, 1920. Well, we're almost out of 1920. We'll be going into 1921. I'm between thinking, agreeing with a lot of this, that Disraeli, or that this is the way the Jews operate, but at the same time, I still don't trust anything any of them say, and I think they do tend to be very boastful and love to portray themselves as just knowing everything and being involved in everything and being the cause of everything. Like being the cause of the Protestant Revolution, I couldn't go along with that. But if Disraeli suggested that, which you said here, I didn't quite, that mighty revolution, no, they're talking about, where did he suggest that?
Revolution in Germany?
Yeah, well, that they're talking about the. When did he live? Maybe I've got my time mixed up. They're talking. You're saying that's the Protestant Revolution he's talking about?
There's an implied analogy between the Revolution of 1848 mm-hmm. in Germany and the Protestant Reformation.
How do you see that? There's a tie together there.
Because
the Greater Reformation.
Yeah, in other words, it would be like the Reformation. There are people who will claim that Calvin, for example, was a Jew, that his name was pronounced Cohen in French.
Right.
Yeah, and I think there may have been some Jews involved in some of the reverberations of Luther's break away from the Catholic Church, because there were people that carried that farther than Luther liked.
Well, yeah, I would say that whatever's going on, they'll try to get into it and influence it. That's one of the greatest truisms. But I would say that this was something that Luther did, and then afterwards, you know, they tried to direct it in whatever way they could.
Yeah. Yeah, Luther was...
But it wasn't their conception, and it wasn't their conspiracy that brought it about, and they used Luther, say, as a pawn or something. I don't, you know, wouldn't go along with that.
Well, this character that Disraeli describes, the one that became the wealthy Jew in England, he had been in Spain before and only pronounced himself a Jew when he arrived in England. It means he'd been pretending to be a Catholic in Spain.
That's right. You're right.
So they do conform if they have to. So it wouldn't be surprising if a lot of Jews stepped on to the Protestant bandwagon and maybe exploited it, pushed it. I mean, I've heard the innuendo that there were Jews involved in Puritanism. I don't know. But, you know, there are people like E. Michael Jones who refer to the Puritans as Judaizers within Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I
think basically anybody that insists on following the Bible very closely instead of resorting to European tradition that pertains to the religion is going to be probably a Judaizer.
Yeah, well, some might be without knowing it, you know, without intending it. But, yeah, there's, I could see some of that. I was looking, I took some notes here, but I can't really find anything too necessary to say in it. Roe with O'Connell,
as to the, you know, persecution of the Jews, Torquemada himself was a Jewish convert.
Well, that's what I thought. The guy who ran that, you know, was the main person in the Spanish Inquisition, was a Jew.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's all this. And this just shows how dangerous Jews are in a society. And there's no way you can tolerate. I mean, how can we, after learning all these things, how can anybody say, well, they're somehow different now, or, you know, or, well, we can't do anything about it. We have to try to learn to live with them, or try to, you know, reduce their influence. That doesn't work. We only have a few seconds. What do you have to say to that, Hattie?
I don't think you should have a Jew in your organization if you have an organization that is supposed to be patriotic or nationalist. That's just obvious. I think
what about government? Geez, that's not a, you know, well, government should be patriotic.
Most definitely.
Right? Yeah, well, I think it's just really, really shocking, you know, what we learn. And whenever I get faced with this stuff, you know, I get so incensed that it's been going on and goes on and goes on and goes on. And I get incensed with the people who don't take it seriously enough, you know, mm-hmm. and don't want to really do something. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And for Hattie and I, we're saying goodnight for now, and join us again next week for another episode.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.